Welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show, a place where business and thought leaders come to weigh in on important sales-related topics that you can use in your sales career and life. I'm your host, Jason Cutter. My mission is to get your help in changing sales from something prospects fear to an act of service they actually seek out and appreciate. Whether you're in sales, leading sales teams, or own a business, I hope this helps you improve your selling effectiveness and you can go out into the world as an authentic persuader. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Authentic Persuasion Show. My very special guest today is Richard Bliss Brook. So Richard is a 40-year veteran of the network marketing industry and ontological coach who is best known for his authenticity and as the man who brought you the incredible viral video series Super MLM Man. If you're familiar with that, if not, check it out. He is the author of the best-selling books. There's two of them, The 4-Year Career and Mach 2 With Your Hair on Fire, which we're going to talk about, principles that landed him on magazines like Success Magazine on the cover there. He believes in playing full out. And what I appreciate about him is he has a very tell it like it is style and so much wisdom, so much experience, so many things. And he has a vision and passion for helping people succeed ethically, transparently, authentically, which of course makes it a perfect fit for a conversation here on the podcast. And he's got a lot of things going on now and new projects coming up. Richard, welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show.
Thank you, Jason. It's an honor to be here.
So let's start off. One of the things in kind of the bio, in your background, obviously you have a lot of things going on now and you're moving forward, but there's the background experience and everything that you've done and learned from network marketing. Now, one thing I know in my experience is the words authenticity and network marketing generally don't go together in the same sentence as far as what people feel in the buying public as their experience, right? That true or not true? Obviously, it can be done successfully.
That'd be true, Bob.
So in the same way that it's not totally fair and reasonable to put the used car salesperson label on everybody that sells cars, because there's people, yes, they fit that model. They're sleazy, they're slimy, they're manipulative. And then there's people who really want to do well by their customers. They want to make a successful career out of it. So it's not fair. So I would love to talk about that. Why does that stigma exist? Where does it come from? How is it perpetuated? The floor is yours. Run with it. On that topic.
Well, I have decades of talking about that because it is my favorite subject. I've always had a love-hate relationship with network marketing. I love the mathematical aspect of the model and the people part and the personal development part and the wealth-building part. But people cuts both ways. So I've enjoyed a wonderful career with a lot of phenomenal people in network marketing. And I hold that as my greatest treasure, the people in my life. And at the same time, the reputation of network marketing suffers from people and how people have gone about promoting the opportunity pretty much in general. And the things about network marketing that have created that is, first of all, anybody can get in. There's no barrier to entry. Like, if you compare like maybe to franchising, you know, what's it going to cost you to get in the franchising profession? At least $25,000. And basically what you're buying is a full-time job. So you're going to have to give up your full-time job and invest $25,000, $250,000, $2.5 million to just play in the franchising business. But in network marketing, if you got a heartbeat and $50, you're in, right? And then, you know, network marketing has a history. Because there is so much upside, and there really is, from a mathematical standpoint, there's an enormous upside in network marketing. So that just has fostered hype. Most of the people getting into network marketing are not successful in life already. Most in most companies are looking for opportunity. They're looking for this to be their chance. And so they bring a certain degree of desperation to their mode of operation, to their attitude, right? Their energy. So they recruit like that. It's kind of a it's just a bad cocktail. On one side, you have these people that you've met and seen and maybe mentoring you that are making enormous amounts of money. And then here you are as a kind of a wannabe, desperate. This maybe will be the time where you make a mark in your life. And you got somebody driving, you know, a Mercedes or a Rolls Royce or a Ferrari and living in a mansion. And it's just a bad cocktail. And the mix of those two So that's where the reputation has come from. And then the other part is it really doesn't take that much to start a network marketing company. Mm. So in the last 40 years, I've probably seen 10,000 companies launch, at least. And there's only 700 that are operating today in North America. So the odds are 95% of any network marketing companies that launch are going to go out of business. And so the owners kind of tend to have a sort of a desperation for, we have to grow super fast. There's typically not any 100-year business plans in network marketing. It's more like, let's see how much money we can make this year and then hope we'll be in business next year. It's just a bad setup all the way around, which has created desperate people that are making nuisance of themselves with their friends and their coworkers, and they lie about their products and their opportunity and overamp it, overhype it. And as we say on the ranch, in many cases, all hat and no cattle. So bad reputation for the last 70 years. I think network marketing is the only product, and it is a product. So it's kind of two aspects of it. We might have a product that we're selling, like a consumable product that generates the cash flow. People buy this and they buy it every month like that. And that's one of the things that you sell in network marketing. But another thing that you sell is the opportunity, the income option, because if you're just selling a bottle of something, well, you're making $100 a month. If you can get 100 people to sell a bottle of something every month, you can make a couple $1,000s a month. And if you get 10,000 of them to sell a bottle every month, you can make a lot more, right? So you're selling the income option. And that's the real tough part in network marketing, because it might be the only product, not the physical product, but the opportunity might be the only product that as a network marketer you sell, and every prospect pretty much on the planet has already decided definitively. They're not like maybe, they're definitively decided they do not want to buy your product, and they're never going to buy your product. And if you want to be successful, you have to figure out how to get through that, get around it. So it's not an easy business.
So much in there. And the first thing is for people listening, and I think this is an important distinction, is network marketing as a business model is a very successful business model, which is instead of me spending $1 million or $30 million on a Super Bowl ad, I'm going to give my workforce a bigger share of the commissions and then pay that through everybody. So the network marketing piece versus multi-level marketing, which is kind of the old word for it with the negative connotation, but network marketing is more, I'm just gonna have a team of salespeople, like Avon did it, Tupperware did it. I mean, those are all in the same category. And it's like, that's where my marketing budget's gonna go, is to paying all these people to be my sales soldiers, if you will. Really negative, terrible side is the pyramid scheme, which is where you have to pay money. And the only way to succeed is to have other people pay you money to join the club. And then that always collapses. So just for people, I mean, I think network marketing is a brilliant marketing growth strategy, obviously, when it's done right. The thing that you said, which I think is huge, is there's no barrier to entry. A pulse and $50, and literally now you're in business, now you're a salesperson. And that's literally what I talk about a lot, where I have a challenge with sales as a whole, is there's no governing body, there's no certification, there's no professional entity ensuring that it's done in an ethical, professional way versus doctors. Imagine if there was $50 and a pulse made you a doctor or a lawyer, right? Like, what havoc would that wreak? But in sales, just show up and hey, you're a salesperson.
Right. And most people's definition of sales is convincing. Let me make claims that will convince you to buy. And if you're not buying yet, then what I need to do is raise my voice, raise the frequency with which I make claims, and raise the value of the claim, right? So,
interesting.
So if miracle didn't get you, then absolute, incredible, guaranteed miracle, right? I just keep upping the hype. I mean, that's how most people sell. And of course, that's obnoxious and it dishonors people. And that's why sales is a tough profession. But Jason, what you and I have figured out is if you do it different, it's actually easy and it's honorable. And instead of alienating people that say no, they actually can become some of your greatest advocates. So one of the things I teach people is people that tell you no, if you treat them right, if you honor what I call honor the no,
okay,
they can become your best prospect list on the planet because they already know what you sell. And if they feel safe in your presence, knowing already what you sell, then what you can rely on is, hey, people change their minds, right? So how many times do you have to see an advertisement on TV or on the internet or social media? You look at it and you go, eh. And the second time, eh. And the third time, eh. And the fourth time, eh. Maybe, but I'm busy right now. You know, the fifth time, and you know, the 19th time, you write that phone number down or you click on that link and you buy something. In traditional advertising, how you get to present to somebody 19 times is you just blast the airwaves, right? But in person-to-person selling, whether it's B2B or network marketing or real estate or whatever, you have to build a relationship such that the person who told you no wants to be around you, wants to hear from you again. In an old school Neanderthal selling, people are so desperate and they're so rough and manipulative and angry at people who say no that they ruin the relationship right then. They never get another chance for a second impression because what, like the way I used to do it in the first 10 years I was selling is if you said no, well, then I made it my mission in life to make you wrong and stupid all in the same next 30 seconds, right? Because I didn't understand the psychology of buying and selling. So there's a different way to do it, which actually is win-win for everyone and doesn't mean that the prospect has to buy, right? Most people that I deal with as prospects don't buy. They don't say yes. And yet I treasure them. And my experience is in most cases, they treasure me. They're not buying from me yet. Maybe they never will, but we have a great relationship. And that's what I would call the new way of selling. And there's techniques that you can deploy to do that, which are different than making people wrong and stupid.
Well, and when I see those salespeople who do that, they make people feel wrong or stupid about the no, and they go into that, I love your Neanderthal caveman sales mode, which is so perfect, right? Just club them over the head and drag them back to the cave, right? Right. That's how I'm going to close my deals. They might win the battle, but they're going to lose the war, right? They might feel like they won that argument about making them feel that way, but it never works long term. It's not a good strategy. And I think that's great. I mean, I think what's interesting is that when you do that, like what you said, is when you have your prospects that tell you no, and it might be a no, not right now. It might be a no, this is not going to be a good fit, right? Like you're selling squares and I need a circle and it's just, it's never a good fit. Or it's just, I don't know yet. I'm not sure. It's not the right time. When you treat them a different way with a long-term relationship, even as a non-customer, that will blow them away because no one else does that. And right. That will set you apart. And like you said, lead to referrals, lead to business later on down the road in the 19th Christmas card that you send them where they go, hey, maybe it is time. Give that Richard guy a chance, right?
Yeah. I'd tell you a story about a salesperson. His name is Spider. He might be retired now, but last time I checked on him, he was selling BMWs in downtown Seattle. But when I met him, which was actually a virtual meeting, I bought a Mercedes from him when he was selling Mercedes for a Mercedes dealership in Bellevue, Washington. And I lived 5 hours away in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And I wanted this particular Mercedes, and this was pre-internet. So I had to call around and find a dealer that had this black Mercedes that I wanted. And they had one. And I got on the phone with Spider and I said, I know this is a little unusual, but I'm busy. I don't have time to come over there and go through all the stuff. So I just want to buy the car and then I want to send somebody over to get it because I don't want to come and get it. And so I actually never met Spider. And one of the things I've always wanted to do is create a picture log of every car and every home I've ever bought, right? Chronological, every car, every home. Because, you know, when you're 65 years old, that's a lot of cars and it's a lot of homes. So I bought this car in 1986. I don't know, maybe it was the 10th car I'd bought at that time. I was maybe 30 years old. And Spider sent me a handwritten note every year, I'm going to guess for at least the next 20 years. And I never bought another car from Spider. In fact, I don't think I bought another Mercedes for about 25 years. But I told more people in the world about Spider. If you need a Mercedes, here's who to call. And then when he went to work for BMW, if you need a BMW, here's who to call. And I actually met him about 10 years later, I think. I happened to be in Seattle, and I wasn't actually buying a car, but I went and found him. And I just wanted to tell him how smart I thought he was. And all he did, it wasn't like a Christmas card or a birthday card. It was once a year, maybe twice a year. He just sent me a handwritten note. Hey, I'm thinking about you. That's it. And what struck me, and you know, it's more popular today, I presume. But now I'm thinking about it. So my wife and I, 6 years ago, we bought a multi-million dollar home here on the island of Lanai. And the realtor gave us a $20 disposable ice chest, like a piece of junk plastic ice chest. And I don't know what was in it, something. Nothing since. And bought lots of cars, nothing from any of the car salesmen. It's so easy to distinguish yourself above the crowd in sales. It's so easy, right? You can yell louder. You can make more claims. You can be more angry. You can manipulate more. But that just makes you more of the 99%. It's right. So easy to become a one percenter by just taking a different strategy and sending a card. Pretty simple, right?
Yeah, that same thing we were talking about a little bit ago about the barrier to entry being so low. I mean, look at the barrier to entry for getting into car sales. You have a pulse. You don't even need $50. Here you go. Now you're selling cars, right?
Right.
Real estate. Okay, take a 60-hour course, pass a test. Now you can help people get into the largest debt of their life. It doesn't mean you know what you're doing about business. And so the bar is so low. And like you're saying, like it doesn't take much to really set yourself apart in the eyes of the consumers. Again, and I love your story because it's not that you went and bought a Mercedes from Spider every year for the next 20 years and those note cards made sense, but it left an impression and who knows what business it's led to for him or with any of his clients. So I think that's great. If we're talking about the things, obviously the negative stigma with sales, just saying sales in general, other than the handwritten cards, other than dealing with prospects who say no, in your experience, what do the good professional salespeople, the successful ones, what do they do? What do they focus on?
They're curious and they listen, which is, if you think about it, it's just the antithesis of the historical sales model. Historical sales model is, I don't care anything about you. What my conversation is about is I want you to care about my product and my sale. And so if I could sort of categorize my language, it would be, you should buy this product and let me tell you why. And then I keep telling you, you should buy it and asking you to buy it. What's the old always be closing or something like that, right? If that doesn't epitomize Neanderthal, I don't know what does, always be closing. So what my cliche would be is always be curious and always be listening. And what does that look like in terms of conversation? Well, I think you mentioned in my bio, I'm an ontological coach, which what does that mean? It means I coach people on their state of being more so than their strategy. So you can be curious as a strategy, right? So I'm going to ask you questions because I realize that's a smart strategy and it'll make you like me and maybe then I'll be able to sell, right? And I don't teach that. I don't teach curiosity as a strategy. I teach it as a state of being. What does that mean? Well, it just starts with, let me coach you around being curious about other people. Now, in order for you to be curious about other people, you can't be a narcissist. You can't have all of your thoughts and concerns and worries and emotions and conversation be about you. When you're in the presence of another person, you can't be thinking about you. To the degree that you're insecure, when you're around other people, you'll be thinking about you and how you look and how you sound and whether or not they like you and whether you say the right things. And a strategy for coaching people around being curious is to actually raise their self-esteem and their confidence. So when they're in presence of other people, they have the basis, they have the grounding to actually be generous enough to make it about the other person. And when you make it about the other person, when you are deeply rooted in being at a spiritual level curious, then you can't make statements, right? Curious people don't make statements. Curious people ask questions, right? But then you can't leave it there, because some people are actually curious and they ask questions. But then when the person is answering the question, they're actually not so curious, right? Because now we move into curious and listening. And what do I mean by listening? Well, almost everybody's idea of listening is that I hear the noise that you're making with your mouth, right? So I ask you a question and you're talking. And if I pass the listening quiz, I could pass a test on what you said, right? So if I ask you, what's your favorite color? And you say blue. Well, I think I'm listening if I remember you said blue, right?
Right.
But the challenge is, the way most people listen is, if I ask you, what's your favorite color? And you say blue, before you even say blue, I'm looking at your makeup and I'm wondering why you chose that particular shade of eyeshadow, or however makeup works, right? Or where'd you get that haircut? And I don't know, Jason, what were you thinking when you picked out that shirt today? So we're thinking about distracting things. We're thinking about judgment things. We're judging people. We're thinking about ourselves. I ask you, what's your favorite color? And I'm thinking, oh, did I just spray saliva on him? Oh, do I look okay? Well, I'd like to tell him what my favorite color is. So I ask you what your favorite color is. You say blue. And I, oh, please ask me what my favorite color is. And mine's blue too, right? So we just have this addiction to not being present to other people. And what we teach people to do in our company is be curious, be the kind of person that is actually curious. And then when people are answering your questions, be present. And so we actually teach a particular approach to listening, which is silence. On our end, it's just dead silence. It's no chatter about all the distracting, narcissistic, insecure things that we might chatter about, which don't allow us to be present. And, you know, people can tell when we're present or not, right? If I ask you, you know, tell me a story, and you're telling me the story, I don't have to be looking at my iPhone while you're telling me the story for you to know if I'm present or not, right? That's like the worst case, not present. I'm looking at my phone while you're talking to me. But people can tell, and they can just tell. It's not about eye contact or nodding your head, or what I hear you saying is you like the color, but it's not about any of that. It's really about, are you silent? Are you with other people? Are you present to them? And when you're curious and you're present, well, here's how you show up for people. You show up for people as one of the most fascinating people they've ever met. And you may have never said anything. So if you have time, I'll tell you a story about where I learned a piece of this.
If there's one thing I know, it's that sales is full of failure. Even if you're a Hall of Fame level sales professional, you can make a great income despite losing more than you're winning. If there's one aspect of sales that most people fear, and what keeps a lot of people even wanting to get into sales, it's getting hit with objections. That is why I wrote my latest book, The Sales Consultant Guide to Overcoming Objections, Yours and Theirs. This is the first in my new series of short books, guides filled with what you need for helping you improve your selling effectiveness. No fluff, no long-winded stories, no filler to make it seem more valuable, just actual foundation-building strategies to help you become aware of the true nature of why your prospects bring up objections, the different type of objections, and then specific ways to overcome them that are universal to most any sales process, product, service, or style. Go to Amazon.com today and get your copy of A Sales Consultant's Guide to Overcoming Objections. Or if you'd rather, as a gift to the listeners of this podcast, email me at jason@cutterconsultinggroup.com and I'll send you a complimentary full version of it as my thank you for listening and supporting this show.
Yeah, go for it. I would love that.
Yeah, so this is like, I'm going to guess, close to 30 years ago. One of my favorite magazines was Psychology Today. It's back in business now, but was out of business for about 10 years. I had my reticular activator going. That's kind of like it was on my radar that I really loved what I did, but I hated how people did it. And I didn't know how to change, but I had an intention to be more user-friendly when it came to sales and recruiting. I was a network marketer, so I wanted to become a different kind of network marketer that did not contribute to the bad stigma. And I didn't know how to do that, but I was open to learning. And so when you're open, you kind of set this little radar in place where now you'll hear things you wouldn't hear before, read things you didn't read, or pay attention to things you wouldn't pay attention to. So I was reading this article, and I probably just caught the headline, and the headline caught my eye. I don't remember it, but it was the editorial staff at Psychology Today did an experiment. And they were not talking about listening. They're basically talking about building rapport, which was more strategic 25, 30 years ago in sales, as opposed to ontological, how I like to teach people to not have it be a strategy, but be it who you are. They weren't talking about that. They were talking about it as a strategy, but still it got my attention big time. So the experiment was the editor of Psychology Today was going to get on a plane in New York City and fly to LAX. And he was going to ask questions of his seatmate to build rapport. And if the seatmate asked the editor questions, he was going to answer the question, but then he was going to follow the answer with another question so that the conversation was always about the seatmate. How I would teach this today is, okay, I would teach the editor, okay, just get on the plane. And who I want you to be for the next 5 hours is curious. And don't think about any strategies, just be curious. But, you know, he used the strategy of where do you live? What do you do for a living? Tell me about your family, right? Kind of the typical question matrix that somebody might teach people about building rapport. So anyway, he did this for the nonstop flight all the way to LAX. They get off the plane. This is pre-TSA. So the staff lets the editor pass through them, but they intercept the seatmate. And they got their clipboards and they say, hey, what did you think about the guy you flew out here with? And the seatmate said this, and it just, when he said, oh, I read this, wow, that's it. I'm changing everything. Like everything I do is changing from this point on. The seatmate said, the most interesting man I've ever met. And so they asked him some questions that you might expect. So why was he coming to LA? He didn't know. Now, I don't know if they puffed up the answers or not. It doesn't matter, right? I got the point. And they asked him, what's he do for a living? Didn't know. You know anything about his family? No. Then, and the last question was, do you know his name? And he said, no. And that's not because he didn't ask. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if he didn't ask, but it also wouldn't surprise me if he asked. And then 3 seconds later, he can't remember, right? Because that happens to all of us. And anyway, he didn't know anything about the editor of Psychology Today, but he thought he was the most interesting man he'd ever met. And I'm thinking, okay, the way I've been trying to be interesting as a recruiter, because what I was selling was a financial option, not quit your job kind of thing, but basically instead of saving and investing your whole life, would be scrimp by, not enjoy life, take $500 or $1,000 and invest it for the next 20 years until I'm almost dead before I can enjoy life. What I was selling people on is, hey, let me show you how to create the equivalent of $1 million or $2 million, but in a separate side income that you get paid for life. So I was selling this idea, right? And the way I was being the most interesting person they'd ever met was from my black Porsche, right? Or my $3,000 custom suits or my $700 Italian shoes. Today, you know, it's probably worth 40 grand, but I think back then I paid $8,000 for my 18 karat gold Rolex President watch, right? So I would like meet people, right? And I'd be like, hi, how are you? Want to know what time it is, right? You still see that's people awesome. Do that today in their selfies, right? Especially the athletes or the movie stars that are into the $50,000 watches and they still kind of take pictures like this, right? So that's how I tried to be interesting. Then I also tried to be interesting by how articulate I was and how confident I was, all of that. And did it work? Well, yeah, it actually did work. temporarily. Like you said earlier, you win the battle but lose the war. Well, how is that? Well, I could sell people, but what I found out in hindsight was they just bought because I was more manipulative than they were. I was more powerful than they were. I just bowled them over, right? As my wife said, I'm just like a bull in a china closet. And that's how I made most of my sales. People just gave up. But they didn't want to be in business with me. They didn't want to be with me forever. Why? I wasn't that fun to be with. I was full of myself. So I just went for all of this. And then the next thing I discovered was an audio tape. You probably know this guy. It's interesting too. I never studied him at all other than this 30-minute audio tape. In about 1986, so I'd been in business now about 10 years, I found an audio tape somewhere, a cassette tape. It was about 30 minutes long, called A New Way of Selling by Larry Wilson. Mm. And Larry Wilson now owns Wilson Learning Systems, which is like one of the largest corporate training companies on the planet. And I found one of his early audio tapes that I just listened to hundreds and hundreds of times, called A New Way of Selling. And it was a B2B audio tape. So the idea was, if you were selling copying machines, the way most people would sell copying machines, if they got an appointment with the buyer, they would just go in and start pitching and closing, pitching and closing, pitching and closing. And Larry's 30-minute audio tape said, hey, let's change the paradigm. What if you spent your first appointment with the buyer asking questions, taking notes, and then what you say is, I'd like to come back in a week or two with a personalized custom proposal to solve the specific problems that you told me you had. And I think the example you used was copying machines, right? Where he would ask, what's the biggest complaint you have about your copying machine? What's the biggest expense? What's the biggest thing that breaks down that messes with productivity? What's the most complicated thing that the non-admin assistant, the non-tech person can't get a copy made, right? What's the biggest problem with your copying machines? And then he taught people, go home, put together a proposal to solve those problems. And if you do that, they don't care what brand copy you're selling. They don't care how long that company's been in business. They don't care how much the copier costs, because you've put together a custom proposal for them to solve their problems. And I kind of put the two of those together, Jason, and I've spent the next 30 plus years studying how to master those arts of being curious about other people, asking them sincere, authentic questions that are not scripted. They're not in a book. They're not in a training program. They come from being present. People want to know, what questions do I ask? I said, well, just ask the first question, and it doesn't really matter what it is. And then if you're paying attention, they'll tell you what the next question to ask is, right? It doesn't come from like, I got my 10 questions I need to try to get asked here, right? It comes from being present. That's how you know the next question. And big piece for me is honoring the no, because, you know, it's kind of interesting. Salespeople that are old school, or another word for them is just super arrogant and presumptuous, where, okay, here's my life, right? I got my life. And let's say you're selling me, Jason. Well, you probably don't know very much about my life. You don't know the conversation my wife and I just had, where she was upset about some other business thing and she couldn't even finish her golf game. So she went to the beach and I hugged her and listened to her. You don't know about that. You don't know who in our family is sick. You don't know who just died. You don't know about the financial issues. You don't know anything about my life. And if you come into my life presuming that your product or your service or your opportunity is even in the top 20 things that are important to me today, you're presumptuous and arrogant and obnoxious. So if you present whatever you have and I say no, what I teach people is honor that. There's way more upside to me building a relationship with you and getting respect and admiration from you than there is in overcoming your objections, right? I don't teach people to overcome any objections. None. If you tell me no, I respect that. And the strategy, if there is a strategy, is right here. This book is usually up instead of your book. To honor you. It's all right here. Well, now, when you read this book, you might think, well, this is all about harassing people over and over and over again. Well, yes, if you're the Grinch, I guess, or whoever this guy is.
And for people listening and not watching this, he's holding up what's normally on the shelf, which is Green Eggs and Ham by Dr. Right. Seuss.
Yeah. Yep. So what I teach people is, hey, if you tell me no, it's not, oh, well, what about if I sold it to you in red? What about if I sold it to you in a box? I'm not suggesting that as a salesperson, you don't look for opportunities to continue the conversation. But if somebody tells you no, what I teach people is live to fight another day. And how do you live to fight another day? Honor the no. And what it sounds like is, hey, Jason, I hear you. And I respect that. It's your life. It's your money. It's your time. And this is my experience with the product or the whatever. And this is why I thought you might be interested. But I don't presume to know how you ought to spend your money or your time. Or what do you ought to surround yourself with in your life? That's your decision, not my decision. I'm just here to introduce and educate. If you have questions, happy to answer them. And I just want you to know, Jason, that I hear it and I get it and I respect it. And I'm going to actually keep making that point, Jason, until I get a confirmation from you. What might that sound like if you were selling me, Jason, and I kind of made that point, hey, I hear you, Jason, I get it. What might you say to me if I made it really clear that I honored your no?
Okay, thanks for understanding. Thanks for saying that.
Yeah, some sort of confirmation, right?
Right.
So I'm looking for that confirmation. And then when I get it, and because I got it, I can make this request. So Jason, would you do me a favor?
Sure.
Would you mind if I just stayed in touch occasionally and let you know how my journey marketing this product or building this whatever, how my career's going, how my journey's going? Can we just stay in touch? Maybe something will change for you. Maybe you'll think of somebody you want to introduce me to. Maybe we'll just become friends. I just want to stay connected and I want you to know about my journey. Would that be okay?
Sure.
Yeah. And you know, one of the reasons why people say okay to that is they're thinking, oh my gosh, I just hit the lottery. All I have to do to not buy today is agree for you to stay in touch and you're not pushy. Sure. Stay in touch all you want. Right. So what does stay in touch look like? I don't know. 3 weeks later, 3 months later, kind of depends on the context, right? Hey, Jason, what about with a fox?
Yeah.
I'm just back in your inbox and it may not be a, hey, Jason, you want to buy today? Probably won't be, but it might be a product testimonial. So let's say, Jason, I'm selling, maybe I'm a mortgage broker and you're a realtor, right? And what I'm trying to sell you on is to use my mortgage broking. Sir, I want to be your mortgage guy, right? And you say, no, I'm good, right? So, hey, I hear you. I get it. I respect that. You have somebody, you like them. I'm all good with that. And I'm going to wait for you to mutter something like, cool, thanks. Will you do me a favor? Sure. Can we just stay in touch? You're going to say yes all day long, right? So in this case, if I'm a mortgage broker and you're a realtor, I might send you something once a week. It won't be what about in a box? What about with a fox? It'll be something to educate you on real estate, something to help your career. Could be an article, could be a blog, could be a podcast. Could be a book, could be an infographic, could be a comic, could be anything, right? I'm going to stay on your radar. And that's my way of saying, what about in a box? What about with a fox? What about in a tree? And then 3 months later, 6 months later, depending on the feedback that I get from you, I might take another run at you. I might say, hey, Jason, can we have coffee? I got something I want to show you. And, you know, I got some new mortgage deal, right? So I got something new to show you this time. And so that's the strategy, if you will, for being persistent as opposed to being obnoxious.
Why do you think people don't go that route? Don't do the curious as not as a strategy, but as a mindset. Don't do the listening piece. From everything you've seen, is there anything in common that keeps people from going that route that you're talking about?
Good question. I think the most obvious is the training to be different is pretty exclusive. Selling with authentic persuasion. The word authentic and selling don't go together very often, right? So if you looked at every book on selling, like one of the ones my mentors taught me to read was Robert Ringer. You ever heard of him?
No.
Google him. Robert Ringer, Winning Through Intimidation.
I should put that on the shelf next to mine.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Exactly. So if you looked at 100 books on selling, how many of those books would talk about authenticity, being real with the client, which, you know, are just different ways of saying being vulnerable, right? Being open, yeah. Having empathy, being humble. Almost every book is going to teach you how to bowl people over with your persuasion. So I think that's one of the reasons. I think the other reason is most of the people in sales, because of the low barrier to entry, are not confident. It's not like most salespeople have a net worth of $5 million and it's okay if the person doesn't buy today. Most salespeople are trying to make commission so they can pay their bills. And so the setup, it's a bad setup because what they're present to in front of a prospect is not the prospect, but the commission. And it might be the money, and it might also be the ranking in the company, right? Am I going to be top 10 this month? Am I going to be number one? Am I going to win the wine opener this week or whatever it is? Am I going to get fired? Am I going to be able to make enough money to cover my bills this month? That's what people are present to. Why? Low barrier of entry. And so the higher the barrier of entry, which is why maybe in a franchise, maybe you don't see the franchise owner out there on the street swinging their sign with the arrow, right? They're not doing that. They're paying somebody $12 an hour to be out there doing that, but they're not doing it. Why? They're not desperate. High barrier of entry. They've invested $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 and they didn't do that foolishly. They have a plan to cover their overhead until they're in the black. But if you look at socioeconomically, salespeople, business people, entrepreneurs, most have an unfortunate level of desperation in the mix. And it doesn't bode well for the reputation of salespeople.
I appreciate that you put it that way. I think that combination, again, the barrier to entry, the desperation, I mean, what it does is, in my experience, it triggers salespeople to be in survival mode and to be in hunting mode instead of farming mode, right? Like, totally, you can't be desperate and impatient as a farmer. Now, you've got to eat today and you've got to blend that with long-term strategies. But yeah, that scarcity mindset that people come into, or the get-rich-quick carrot that's out there. And if they're not getting rich quick, then they must be doing something wrong. So that means they got to try harder and bulldoze more people, not less people.
Yeah.
It just gets into this terrible loop.
And that's what I tell people. And they say, well, okay, well, that's great. But what about sense of urgency? What about for a go-getter? What about type A? What about somebody? I want to make as much money as I can. Great. Talk to more people.
Yeah.
Right? Have more better work ethic than trying to have everyone you talk to buy. Talk to more people and take care of the people you talk to and take care of the no's and build a database of people that find you to be the most interesting person they've ever met, even if they didn't buy from you. That's how you maximize your income. And maybe that's a little slower pace, but I don't think so.
No.
And I could never advise somebody, go see how much money you can make this year, regardless of the consequences to your reputation, to your network, to your Rolodex, to your health, to your family. I don't coach people on that track.
No. And I think that sometimes it's more of a numbers game. And you said this, you gave the blueprint. Sometimes if you come at it from curiosity as a mindset and a belief system and listen, you have longer conversations, right? When you don't do that, you have shorter conversations that get to a no. When you actually focus on doing things different, you could actually have less conversations per day because they're going to equal more and you're actually going to have a higher conversion, which is counterintuitive for the way most salespeople, which is it's a numbers game, right?
Right.
If I go to a bar and I ask 100 women out cold, just to their face, one of them should say yes. That should work, right? And so people take that in sales. They think, okay, if I just talk to 100 people and instantly pitch them, somebody's going to say yes versus right. the slower, interesting way.
Yes. And I didn't get into it, but I don't teach people to overcome objections, but I do teach people to listen through objections. Mm. Which
interesting.
One of the common one it used to be, not so much anymore, but it used to be in network marketing. Oh, that's a pyramid scheme. And of course, what I did for the first 10 years of my career was make them wrong and stupid, right? And so my immediate response was, no, it's not. And they would say, well, yes, it is. And I said, no, it's not. Oh, yes, it is. No.
Like a 2-year-old.
Well, this conversation is not going to last very long, right? But if they would let me, I'd say, want me to prove to you it's not a pyramid scheme? So I would say, it's not illegal. I would say, it's illegal. I said, it's not illegal. Oh, yeah, my uncle, you know, I know, I've read. No, it's actually not illegal. What I want to say, and I actually always say it, is you actually don't know anything about my business. You don't do my business. You're just an observer. You're an amateur. I'm a professional. I do this full time. If I say it's legal, I know more about my business than you do. I'm probably right. You're probably wrong. I want to say all of that, right?
Right.
But instead, what I said, if they give me a chance, is, well, in 1979, the Federal Trade Commission versus Amway prevailed that as long as you're selling a legitimate product, products that people are buying, there's no such thing as a pyramid scheme in network marketing. They're two entirely different concepts. Now, if there's no product, yes, the FTC is successfully prosecuted every once in a while something as a pyramid scheme, but not what I'm doing, right? And it's all based on Amway versus the FTC 1979. Have you read that ruling? Right? That's what I used to say. And it doesn't matter that the Federal Trade Commission versus Amway, it doesn't matter, because if they say it's a pyramid scheme, what I've learned is they're afraid and they have an opinion, right? But I don't know anything about it. So what listening through objections does, instead of make them wrong and stupid and give them all the facts, is simply ask them, what do you mean by that? And I use pyramid scheme as a great example, because my experience is some people think a pyramid scheme is a business model that's illegal.
Got it.
And they don't want to go to jail. Some people think a pyramid scheme is just morality. They don't know anything about the legality of it, and they don't really care. What they call a pyramid scheme is a business proposition that's immoral.
Got it.
Taking advantage of people, and they don't want to take advantage of people. Some people think a pyramid scheme, they don't know anything about the legality of it, and they could care less about the morality of it. They think it is unfair, kind of like, well, the people at the top make all the money and the little guys don't make any money, right? Which is not necessarily true, but there's no cheese down the tunnel of explaining how that's not necessarily true. The cheese is asking, what do you mean by that? It doesn't make sense. It's just not a viable model, because if everybody recruited everybody, sooner or later, the whole world would be a distributor. And right. So they're coming not from morality and not from legality. It's a dysfunctional business model, or it's not fair, right? It doesn't work long term. So instead of arguing with them, what I teach people to do is just keep drilling down and understanding them, which is all you're doing there is practicing the art of seek to understand before you seek to be understood, right? Which is a pretty basic rapport building, relationship building principle. So how I can stay in conversation with somebody who says no is by asking them to tell me about the no. How do you see that? Where did you learn that? How do you feel about that? What are you afraid of? What's the story you tell yourself? Where did you get those facts? How does it feel? And as long as they'll tell me their stories, I'll ask questions and listen. And will I ever offer a different point of view? Yeah, there is a point in time, in my experience, where if you seek to understand people's point of view deeply enough, they'll actually have a state change, and they'll basically go from this. So if you're here, whether it's a pyramid scheme or it's too expensive or I don't have time or whatever, right? I'm a vegan. I don't buy that stuff. Doesn't matter, right? So if they're here and I ask them enough questions about why they're here, and I never counter their answers, I just keep being present and curious. Tell me about that. Teach me about that. I'm coming from total empathy. I want to understand, not to manipulate and not to counter your point of view. I actually want to understand it. And if I stay in that mode long enough, my experience is at some point people let go, because most objections aren't true anyway, right? Somebody says it's too expensive. Really? Let's go back through your credit card receipts for the last 24 months and look at all the things that you bought that were too expensive compared to what, right? So we know it's a BS objection, but of course you can't call people on that. People say, I don't have time. Really? We have time for things we want to do, right? So the truth is you do have time. You just don't want to do it. People say, I can't sell. I used to tell people that tell me I can't sell. I'd say, oh yeah, really? How come? And I'd let them build a big case for how they can't sell. And then I'd tell them, wow, I'm going to let you go, Jason. You sold me. You're a horrible salesperson. I'm buying that. So I'm going to let you go because you sold me, right? Which is just horse's ass to people.
Yeah.
Right? Because people sell anything they're passionate about, whether they get money for it or not, right? And what I found out about people in pyramid schemes is people would say, it's a pyramid scheme. And then they would learn enough about it, right, to get in it. And they'd be in it for like 3 or 4 or 5 weeks or months. And they'd quit because it wasn't a get-rich-quick scheme. So they were like, no, it's a pyramid scheme. And then they would say, okay, well, maybe I'll try it. And they find out it's not a pyramid scheme and they quit, right? So it wasn't that
it takes actual work.
Right. So people's objections are rarely true. What's true is they have fears, they have frustrations, they have preferences, they have values, they have priorities, they have stories. And if you want to stay in the conversation and maybe have a chance to present your point of view, you got to stay curious until they let go. And when they let go, basically what they're telling you is you're safe. You have learned enough about me. You've demonstrated enough empathy. You've asked enough questions. You've actually listened. You haven't tried to make me wrong or stupid. You're safe. And when the prospect finds that we're safe, they tend to change the conversation to something that's more truthful. And when the prospect can get more truthful for you, like instead of I don't have time, they can say, I don't see the value, right? Then maybe we can shift how we present what we're selling.
Right.
Or they tell us, I see what you're selling and I can buy the exact same thing for half the price. I just didn't tell you that early on. I just said it was too expensive. Okay. So what is the brand and where can you buy it for half the price? And of course, if they would show you, well, here it is right here in Costco and let's look at the ingredient deck and the features and benefits. And it's the exact same product for half the price. As a salesperson, you'd probably go, okay, I'm going to move on.
Well, and I think that that whole conversation, that whole thing with the listening and diving deep, again, all the stuff that we've talked about over these 58 minutes plus or minus, I think that's just such a roadmap for people to do sales differently. And if they take even some of those of what you've talked about, it's so radically different than what other people in sales do, and radically different than what the prospective customer is worried about and has experienced in the past and is worried about experiencing this time with said salesperson, that if you're different in any one of those categories, not even all of them would be great, but even just some of them, it will blow the minds of the prospects and open up so many doors and move some conversations forward. So let's talk about, as we wrap up here, so you have your book. So you have Mach 2 with Your Hair on Fire and The Four-Year Career. Talk a little bit about those and who's the best audience for those.
Mach 2 with Your Hair on Fire is The Art of Personal Vision and Self-Motivation. And that book is for anyone in any profession that wants to learn the art and science of creating internal motivation, which is different from, I want to win the contest, I want to make the money, I want to whatever, the external carrot, right? Instead of the carrot out there, it's let's figure out how to eat the carrot, right? Have the carrot be inside of us and how to just create that fire inside where you're then creating the motivation. And how I define motivation, lots of different ways to define it, but I define it as enthusiasm and persistence, and courage and creativity and physical energy. And when you create that energy, that fire inside, you and I can do anything. We can certainly call on one person a day, right? So if you just called on one person a day and you did that for 90 days, you'd be in the top 1% or 1/100th of 1% of every salesperson in whatever profession you're in, right? So anybody can do that. It takes like 15 minutes, maybe 30 minutes. But where do you get the motivation to do it every day if somebody's not holding you accountable, if somebody's not dangling a carrot in front of you, if you don't win a prize if you do it? Vision of self-motivation is all about is unhitching yourself from being manipulated by whoever's dangling the carrot. Whatever the form the carrot's in, whatever you have to do to get the carrot. Oh, here's the carrot. Oh, no, here's the carrot's over here now. So it's like, well, here's the carrot. Where's the carrot, right? Make it all come from inside. And it doesn't matter if you're pursuing weight loss, reinventing the relationship with your spouse, your family, making money, building a business, helping your community. Everything takes self-motivation. That's what Mach 2 is about. It's for anyone who wants to transform their life. And the four-year career, conversely, is just about how to build an asset income in network marketing in about 4 years. Might take 7. Some people it takes 17, right? So, but I've seen people do it also in 2. It's about the model of network marketing. It's a very fact-based, mathematical-based, pros and cons, good, bad, and ugly. It's not a sales pitch for network marketing. It's an education in how and why the model works, including how and why it only works for about 2 out of 100 people to try it. The operative word be the other 98, try it.
Right.
And it is not that easy because almost everybody you're going to ask to look at your network marketing opportunity is going to say no. And almost everybody's an understatement.
Yes. So you have these two, and what are you working on next?
People go to my website, richardbrook.com. You'll see a lot of stuff. Some of it's about network marketing, and some of it's just about being an entrepreneur, being a leader, about being present and listening, developing yourself to be more confident, more powerful in whatever in life you want to do. So I coach people one-on-one. I do mini masterminds. I coach on Zoom hundreds and hundreds of people at the same time through various programs. Normally, I do live workshops around the world. So there's a lot of stuff there, and most of it's free. That's what awesome. I'm up to.
I love it. Richard, thanks for joining me on the show, and thanks for sharing all these things, both from the perspective of the network marketing experience you have, but how it applies to everything, and so much good stuff. So Richard, thanks for joining me on the show.
You're welcome, Jason. Great honor. Appreciate being here.
And that's it for this episode. I'll catch everybody on the next conversation about authentic persuasion. Thanks for tuning into the Authentic Persuasion Show. If you found value in this episode, please do 2 things. Subscribe so you can get each new episode and share this episode with anyone else you know in sales. Together, we can help shift the way sales is done. And if you want to find out more information about how to transform your sales career, or you want help with shifting your sales team from order takers to quota breakers, go to jasoncutter.com. Don't forget that everything in life is sales, and I will catch you on the next episode of the Authentic Persuasion Show.